I'm so here for dateable cryptids becoming a new vampire, which was the new werewolf, which was the new merman?
Mermen, who were the new gargoyles, yes.
Yeah. I should keep up with this better. But yes, cryptids are becoming a thing, basically because everybody wants to date them in Tumblr, and who can blame them?
Talking about young adult literature is not for the faint of heart. There's fashion atrocities, queer subtext, problematic love interests, and that's just for a start. But never fear, because Carrie and Marie are here, and this is Go Your Own YA.
Readers and listeners, welcome to Go Your Own YA podcast. Carrie, what makes you qualified to talk about young adult literature?
Wow, I was not prepared for this question. I'm qualified to talk about young adult literature because I'm here and I've got a microphone in front of me, and isn't that all I need?
Perfect.
Marie, how about you? What brings you here and why are you qualified to be here?
Every time the medical industrial complex pisses me off, I buy a book.
And the publishing industry thanks you for your service.
I just got a new NYPL card, and it was a very interesting experience because I hadn't stepped foot in an NYPL library in probably about a decade. And I was getting my new library card, and I understand why the librarian was in the mood she was in. It was the end of the day. She was working in the central children's room. Millions of tourists were taking pictures with the original Winnie the Pooh. I get it. But I was explaining, she was like, oh, wait until the 29th and the Mid-Manhattan Library will be open. Like, but I'm a blogger. And she's like, oh, YA is over there too. And I'm like, but I read all the things. Well, no, it was the end of the day and I had just come from an unsuccessful visit with the pharmacy. So my actual thought was, I know more than you.
I know that feeling very well. So we are gathered here today to discuss one book in particular. This week we're talking about Boy Meets Boy by David Levithan.
Carrie, it's your turn because I went on the Lost episode.
As readers and listeners, there's a Lost episode. Last week we had one of our milestones in hosting a podcast. We recorded an entire episode and lost it. So now we feel like big kids.
Mm-hmm. Stephened out an entire audio track.
Well, let me tell you then about Boy Meets Boy. It is a very short book. It is a very sweet book in a lot of ways. Our main character is a boy named Paul. He is a sophomore at a high school like no other, says the back of the book. It's a high school in New Jersey, but it's an awesome utopian New Jersey. He falls in love with another boy, and that's it. That's the whole book.
And that's what was so remarkable about it. Because at the time it was published, queer representation in the literature, you know, many wonderful authors getting their work out there. But happy endings were in short supply.
Yeah, if the cover of the book doesn't tip you off with the adorable little candy heart spelling out the title, this is a love story with a happy ending. A queer love story with a happy ending. And thank God for it. So David Levithan wrote this book, he says in the intro, as a Valentine for his friends. And that's exactly what it reads as. It's a very sweet and hopeful and idyllic story.
Yes, I agree with all of these things. And I also found it very interesting. It's also something David Levithan himself notes in the Q&A that's at the end of the 10th anniversary edition of the book. And if you do get a copy, I really recommend getting that one because he asks all of the questions I would have asked if we interviewed him for this podcast. Carrie, how did you find out about this book?
That is a really good question. Probably I heard David Levithan's name mentioned along with the Babysitter's Club. So, of course, that's interest for me right there, that he was one of the main behind the scenes people working on that series. Our mutual friend Lisa, who is starting to come up on this podcast as much as BSC or Betsy Tacy, she's the one who asked me to go with her to the book signing and reading of Are We There Yet? And while I was there, I picked up Boy Meets Boy and went home and probably read it that evening and just really enjoyed it. How about you?
I had a Google alert for Francesca Block, and she's name checked in either the original blurb or one of the reviews, and she is definitely name checked in the Q&A in the 10th anniversary edition. He names Weetzibat as the direct inspiration for the book.
Yes, that so does not surprise me at all.
Not one bit.
No.
Okay, readers and listeners, we should probably start off with some content warnings because this is indeed a book that's over a decade old. And my number one content warning listed on the show notes is why, oh why, Infinite Darlene?
Yeah. That shows up in my notes as well. Infinite Darlene is a character who deserves a lot better and deserves to be treated much better.
In the 10th anniversary edition, which I'm going to keep mentioning because this is probably the copy that many of you readers will pick up, there is a short story about her at the end of the book. And in the story, she's explicitly named as a trans woman. Now, in the book, the main character's description of her vacillates between drag queen, trans woman, and somebody who inhabits both places. While this is probably a realistic depiction of the inside of a 16-year-old white boy from New Jersey's understanding of gender identity, especially pre-living on the internet, because like many of these books, I imagine it was probably written in the late 90s or the very early 2000s.
This is a book that was published in 2003.
Oh, so I was just going into college.
Oh my God.
Sorry I keep doing that to you.
Stop being young. How dare you?
But I probably discovered it around 2004, 2005 maybe?
Mm-hmm. That's about when I read it, I think.
Infinite Darlene is a character with a very charming personality who wants good things for a lot of people and has no tolerance for bullshit. And the author has a lot of love for her. And I do think that if he ever decided to write that novel, he would need to collaborate with an own voices writer. Anyway, the villain of the book is incredibly cruel in the way that he speaks about her, and it's a very hurtful thing. And readers, if you are sensitive to that kind of content, this is probably not a book that you should read.
Agreed.
My second point is the book is set in New Jersey and very close to New York City, but it is pretty damn white.
It is very, very white and very male dominated.
Yes.
Does this book even like get close to passing the Bechdel test? I don't think
it does, because of Trilby, Infinite Darlene, and Amber.
Oh, thank God.
So we will get to all of these fantastic characters.
We'll get to them later, yes.
And my other content warning is there is a family that is emotionally abusive to somebody, and I will get more into it when we discuss the plot of the book and the setting of the book. But in contrast to what's going on, and also being a 32-year-old reader, thinking of all the solutions that could have happened is very hard. So we originally like to start discussing the book. I feel like for such a short book, there's so much
to talk about in this book. I say we start with our protagonist, Paul.
The original title for the book is Paul is Gay, which is a Beatles reference, but nobody got it. So he changed it.
Paul is definitely gay and has very good sense of self.
That's what his kindergarten teacher writes on his report card, which is something that would get a teacher fired, FYI.
Yeah. As an educator, no, just no, for so many reasons. No. And I yelled this at the book as I was reading it.
It is based on a true story. David Levithan's fifth grade teacher did figure that out. And fortunately, he comes from a very liberal family that, you know, always included his uncle's partner with their, you know, family gatherings and such. So he was very lucky. But teachers, don't out your students.
Absolutely not.
Readers and listeners, we will provide a few sources for you in the notes if you are dealing with a situation like Tony. Carrie is a professional, but in a very different stage of life. I am not a professional. I'm a professional head case.
Oh, I'm one of those too.
Now, I'm waiting for the first email we get about being glib about mental illness, and I'm like, let me tell you a thing.
Yeah. Let's sit down and talk about mental illness. So, Paul, talk about poor Paul.
My primary note for him is the 5 do's and 500 don'ts of being Paul. Paul is a very sweet, very well-meaning boy, and he is at a life stage where he is allowed to figure these things out and be awkward and imperfect about them. Readers and listeners, if you, as a 30-year-old, are experiencing the same things from your partner, run.
Do not do these things.
Do not do any of these things.
Yes. Paul makes a lot of grand gestures, the kind that are really wonderful to read about and see.
Absolutely.
In movies. And trust me, when those things happen to you, they are freaky as hell and they make you want to run. Mm-hmm. There's no good there. And I guess that's another thing that's a bit of a problem with this or with any romance novel, that we're telling people this is how you build relationships with people and this is how romantic relationships work, and it's not.
Mm-hmm. I mean, this is a much healthier depiction of a relationship and how once you go about them than many books I had read at the time. There's Paul and Noah have a scene where they're talking about, like, they're getting to know each other for the first time, and Paul, in his inner narrative, is talking about how their conversation is very easy and neither of them are trying to look at the words beneath the words, and there's no games being played, and that feels very good to him. And that is something starkly original in romance novels that were written around this time period.
Is that the conversation where they're talking in pencil sketches as opposed to Technicolor?
It may be.
I love that passage. That does get a little bit at the idealism of beginning a new relationship. We can talk about the bad dates and bad boyfriends, because this is not a bad date and we will not be bad boyfriends.
Yeah, so Noah is definitely in the good boyfriends section of our website, which may or may not exist. It feels a little weird for 30-somethings to be talking about,
yes,
good and bad boys. It's probably not.
Yeah, I have a problem with all of the names of the boys in this book because they almost all are like one syllable names. So I have to keep thinking, like, which one's
There's
Paul,
a Tony,
which one's like Ted, which one's like Chet, and which one is like Kyle, and which one is other Chet.
This is why you want diversity in your books.
At the very
the
least,
very least,
you want your readers to be able to remember the difference between your characters. Tony's a two-syllable name, but then Paul's other best friend is Joni.
Like, are you doing this on purpose, David? Another thing that makes this book stand out is it's not only a gay utopia in the way that LGBTQAI plus people are treated, but also in that this is a magical realist book.
The Francesca Leo Block influence does not surprise me. It's all over the book. There's magical scenes where they're dancing in the self-help section of the bookstore.
That's where they meet.
Yes, they meet in the bookstore, and Paul meets his best friend Tony at the Strand. So there's like magical bookstore moments. There's a dance, a school dance someone has to dance with the portrait of the wealthy old lady who donated money to the school. There's these wonderful, quirky things. They do painting together. They put on Chet Baker in Noah's beautiful bedroom, and they paint the music. Yeah, the quirk is piled on, but it's piled on so nicely. Paul's hometown is, he says at the beginning of the book, there isn't really a gay scene or a straight scene in our town. They got all mixed up a while back, which I think is for the best.
It's an interesting viewpoint. I feel it's one that was very popular at that time, where integration into mainstream society was something that was, you know, an end goal. And a lot of people thought it was the end goal for everybody. And I do feel like there's more fragmentation nowadays and a little bit more, I don't want to use the word like separatism, but I do feel that everybody is hurting so much that we just want to take our toys and go home. And I think that, you know, when you have your feelings hurt, it's time to take your toys home, like, and sit with that for a while and take care of the friends you do care about. So it's something from a very different point in time, but it's also a beautiful thing in its own right. And I will give David Levithan props for this, that even in his queer utopia, bad stuff happens, both in, you know, a major way from outside forces and also from within the community and with people hurting each other. Because I go to A Camp, which is basically as close to queer utopia as you can get, at least for queer ladies and their friends. The definition's a little nebulous. Go check the website for updates. But trans ladies are most certainly welcome. And even in this place that is amazing and magical and beautiful, it is not amazing and magical and beautiful for everybody. I am sure that, you know, the two characters in the book that are not white would probably have a very different view of living in suburban New Jersey, which my theory is it's Montclair. In the Q&A, he says you can triangulate it if you pay attention. I'm pretty sure it's Montclair, New Jersey, which is one of my favorite places ever, and also the home of the biggest used bookstore in New Jersey.
And Montclair is pretty much where I was picturing this taking place.
Montclair, readers and listeners who have not grown up in New Jersey or, you know, somewhere in the mid-Atlantic region of the United States, it's a charming little quirky semi-urban, semi-suburban town where you could quite easily picture many of the things in this book happening.
It is also the setting for the book and the movie Cheaper by the Dozen and the story of the Gilbreth family.
See, I read the Lizzie Skernick takedown of the book, and I just understand that Frank Gilbreth is pretty much the worst dad in literature.
So. Oh my God, he was terrible. Yes.
But I think I need to read it to understand Bells on Her Toes, which is the one where he dies. Which...
he dies at the end of Cheaper by the Dozen.
Oh, excellent.
You get rid of him, and then you just get to concentrate on Lillian, who is awesome.
Yes.
She was a badass.
Oh, my goodness. Yes. So probably takes place in New Jersey. New Jersey is a very quirky, interesting state. I have been reading the magazine Weird New Jersey since I was a junior in high school, and I do recommend getting your hands on a copy if you can, or at least checking out the website, even though it focuses on things which are kind of like a little spooky-ooky or paranormal or like that stuff. There is a lot about like roadside attractions, history, interesting characters who live in different places, and it is imperfect in a way that, you know, that quirky older white dude edited. Apparently Mark and Mark are quite nice, but yeah, there will be short-sightedness in those respects. So reader beware, but also definitely worth checking out if you did like the setting of this book.
If you'd like to learn more about New Jersey, contact us. We'll tell you all about it.
And seriously, readers and listeners, we have a Twitter, we have an email, we have a Facebook group. We would love to hear from you. Tell us what you're reading. Tell us if you read this book. Tell us what you're making. Tell us what you think of us. Or except maybe don't.
No, not the last one.
Not the last
don't
one.
Don't tell us those things.
We do appreciate constructive criticism, but mean-spirited comments will just be printed out and made into kitty litter. And my cats poop a lot. So back to the book. So the overarching plot of this book is that Paul meets Noah. They fall in love. Paul has complicated feelings about his ex, who has complicated feelings about boys and girls. And then also, Paul's best friend, Tony, has horrible religious parents who are trying to pray the gay out of him.
And Paul's other best friend, Joni, has fallen for a new guy.
I just want to know, why isn't anybody helping Joni? Joni is in an abusive relationship. Please help Joni.
That's true. If you don't read it carefully, this might be something that you miss out and you're just like, you know, yeah, it sucks that Joni isn't like really friends with Paul anymore. That's not very nice of her at all. Why isn't she nicer to our protagonist? Why aren't they still friends?
I mean, straight up, Chad or Chet or whatever the fuck his name is, he repeatedly and offensively misgenders Infinite Darlene. And let me tell you, if your love interest misgenders your friends, like, feed them to the Jersey Devil. Fuck them.
You can find more about the Jersey Devil at your local library.
Or in a copy of Weird New Jersey.
Yes. Oh, yeah, that's what we were plugging earlier, not the libraries.
No Jersey Devil in this book, though, unfortunately.
No, unless you want to count What's-His-Face as being a Jersey Devil.
Oh, it's Chuck, because Chuck. Infinite Darlene says, I call him, it's something like, I call him Schmuck because the alternate is too unladylike for
yes.
someone like me. So, you know, Paul messes up a lot of things, but Paul, to his credit, does untangle all of these things by the end, and it takes people like Infinite Darlene and Infinite Darlene's nemesis, Trilby Pope, which this is very funny yes. because a trilby is a stingy brim fedora, and I'm sure we all know what fedoras symbolize, but like, Trilby in the book is not that bad. She and Infinite Darlene are just kind of at each other's throats for being too similar, and apparently they want to date all the same guys, which is not actually a reason for girls to have,
you know,
issues
girls
with each other,
only have issues with each other about guys. You know, that's all girls care about.
Sigh.
Has David Levithan ever met a woman?
Well, he met me.
And me. He met the two of us and Anne M. Martin. And from that, we get these characters.
You would think that after editing 60 Babysitter's Club novels, he would understand how female friendship
works.
Yes. But also, I understand the book is from Paul's point of view, and Paul
right.
is kind of a self-centered teenager. He's a very sweet boy and a very caring boy, but he, you know, his frontal lobe isn't quite developed yet.
Right. You know, he's led by his hormones. He's not always making the best decisions. He's still thinking about his ex, and he's trying to balance that along with being a good boyfriend to his new boyfriend and trying to be a good friend to his best friend who, you know, lives one town over and might as well live in a completely different world.
Which is a very real thing in New Jersey.
Yep. Yep.
And I imagine in suburbia in many places in the country.
Yes.
Paul is, you know, he's a lovely kid. He's just... He tries. And I think that that's something that teen readers will identify with, that they are trying to do the right thing. And by doing the right thing, they keep doing the right. Hell, I identify with
no
that.
Kidding.
Like, I'm just trying to make it better. How did I make it worse?
Yeah. We are probably all Paul in some way.
Mm-hmm. But since this is a Queertopia book, things do work out by the end. Paul sorts out his feelings with Kyle, his ex. He helps Tony bring his parents to understand his point of view. And this is where I took offense. The thing is that I probably learned it from Captain Awkward. You don't need to traumatize yourself to be someone, even your parents' educational resource. They don't need to learn from you. Your responsibility is yourself. See, I got super lucky that, you know, I didn't come out until I was 29. I got very lucky. My family loves my partner very, very, very much. And I also love her very much. And her family is the same with me. But there's a reason that people nowadays say, take care of yourself until you reach the majority. because it is very hard to sever the ties that bind legally and emotionally. Take care of yourself until you can get out. And Tony does something super noble. He is standing up for who he is and what he believes, and trying to bring his parents over to his point of view and make them see that he's safe and he's good and this way of living won't hurt him. But the thing is, that's not Tony's responsibility. That's Tony's parents' responsibility.
Yeah, I worry about Tony.
Yeah, 2 years is a lot.
Yeah, he is stuck there for a few years. And, you know, I think we both, you and I, live in places that teenagers run to after they come out to their families and no longer feel welcomed or safe. So this is something that we see, and I worry for this imaginary teenager. I want him to stay safe.
There's a scene where Paul is talking to his parents and his brother about it, and they are very caring and sympathetic, but I'm like, why aren't you doing something, you kind, intelligent, and rich TBH parents, if you know enough that PFLAG is a resource? And she says, why don't we get PFLAG on them? I'm like, you know what? Why don't you get PFLAG on them? Why don't you help Tony become an emancipated minor?
Yes.
Because this is something where Tony is afraid, and his parents are like, they've got that silent thing going on, which means, I mean, I'm reading a lot between the lines, which I think a lot happens, like, when the friends are out of the house. And now Tony, as a character, is very honest, but also, you know, I'm worried about this imaginary teenager.
Right, yeah. Remember, this was written not too terribly long after My So-Called Life. You know, I see him following the Ricky arc. I see him following the arc of the boy he's based on from the Patty Griffin song, which I want to link to in the show notes with the caveat that, you know, it's a terribly sad story and there's slurs in the chorus, and it's a song that does not end well for that Tony. And I know David Levithan says that he put that song on when he was writing the book and it gave him inspiration, and I think, well, why didn't you give Tony a better ending? Well, I mean, he lives, so that's better than the Patty Griffin song. I appreciate that.
So I'm just going to pretend, since David Levithan in the Q&A says that he doesn't imagine an end for the characters after the story is over, that he considers everything self-contained. So I get to imagine what happens, and I imagine he goes to NYU and he has a wonderful drama professor named Edward Zani.
Yes! Yes! I have another theory about Paul and Noah and who they get to grow up to be, who show up in another book. We'll talk about
that.
No,
please. Wait, I want to hear this now.
I want Paul and Noah to grow up and be the dads from Lola.
Oh, that is so cute. The timing doesn't quite work.
I don't care that the timing doesn't work because they live in a magical utopia.
That's true. And because of the lack of technology, we'll just say that it took place in the early 90s.
It feels early 90s enough to me. It doesn't feel that different from when I was growing up, except for the whole utopia thing.
Right? Okay, I canon accepted.
I'm totally good with this.
Maybe we should have, like, a fanon corner.
Isn't that what this whole thing is?
Essentially. And also, I predict that Infinite Darlene and Shelby Pope end up being friends for life, and they go on a road trip where they set up elaborate Home Alone style traps for transphobic people and misogynists and trans misogynists and everybody who makes life terrible for
yes.
people. And I want somebody to write this, but I want it to be own voices.
Yeah, I love that idea, and someone needs to write it. You had some suggestions.
I did. There's a couple of writers on Twitter that I know that I think would do real justice to this. That kind of story.
Oh, you know what? Let's talk. We talked about Tony's parents. Let's talk about Paul's parents for a bit, because we have been looking at parents.
They're really adorable, but they are very much on the sidelines of this novel, more so than a lot of young adult novels I've read. Like, Paul is very... I think he takes them for granted a little bit.
Yeah.
I'm also speaking with the bitterness of a motherless daughter.
Yep.
Carrie and I are both members of the Dead Parent Society.
It's a great club. We meet every Thursday.
We stand on things and shout poetry.
Today would have been my dad's 75th birthday, and I like to think that he would appreciate this story.
Last Friday would have been my mom's, let's see, she was born in 52. She was 65th birthday?
65th, 10 years younger than my dad.
She would have retired this year.
Oh.
So I think between the hanging out in a kiddie pool on the lawn, blithely giving the finger to every parent she couldn't give the finger to before.
Yep.
I think this is also a story she may have appreciated because it's pretty cute. And my mother was an English teacher before she was a school principal and definitely was somebody who very quietly guided my love of good literature. And we had the same favorite book, which is A Tree Grows in Brooklyn, which I love. Probably a book we'll never be able to discuss on this podcast. Yeah, it's just, it doesn't hold up unless you have a very particular background of immigrant white people in your family living in New York. But it was her favorite book, and it is one of my favorite books. And I think this is something she probably would have thought was pretty cute.
Yeah, Paul's parents are on the sidelines, but they are quietly supportive, and they serve as a contrast to Tony's parents. Tony says at one point, in the next election, I'm voting for your mom to be the next god.
I loved that. Paul's parents are great. I also appreciate Jay, but that's maybe because I'm an older sister. Yes.
As another older sibling, I enjoy Jay.
Yeah, he is, like, he gives Paul a lot of guff, but he's an, like, it's not in a cruel way. It's just that he's an older sibling, and he's dealing with all of the things that being an older sibling entails, so that's how we deal with it.
Yep.
We give our little siblings guff.
Our little siblings and all their annoying friends. And Noah, Noah's got a younger sister who comes at this from the opposite end, the dealing with your older brother and his annoying friends. And she is probably just as protective of Noah as Jay may quietly be of Paul.
Mm-hmm. I identify with Claudia a lot. I feel like her relationship with Noah is very much like my relationship with my brother, even though he's 6 years younger than me. And Noah has parents who are in the airline industry, so they are almost never home. We only meet one of them very late in the book. And they obviously love their kids very much, but they're away making a good living for them. So Noah and Claudia are on their own much of the time. So that leads Claudia to feeling like she's got to step up and be a parent.
I'm looking through my notes again. Just keep going back to Paul is definitely gay and has very good sense of self.
Carrie, did you ever receive feedback on a report card that stayed with you?
I have seen some report cards and like developmental forms from when I was younger that captured me very well and that still ring true today. But if you are asking whether any of my teachers pegged my sexual orientation, the answer is no, and they would have been wrong either way. I look at this, I look at Paul at age 5, and I know when I was in kindergarten, I was chasing my kindergarten boyfriend around. But I also know that the year before that, I was chasing a girl around.
I have a story from high school, where my two very good friends at the time, I went to an all-girls Catholic high school. There were less than 100 of us to a grade. It was fairly liberal for what it was. We were run by basically lady Jesuits, which will mean something if you're Catholic or exposed to many Catholics. But essentially, they were a very educationally focused, a very service-focused order, and I was very lucky to go to that school. I appreciated it much more once I left. So my two best friends in high school went to our religion teacher, who was, you know, very beloved, you know, figure by all of us, very warm, caring person who would sit and talk with us. And both of them came out as bisexual to her. And she said, well, maybe, maybe not. It could be, but, you know, lots of teenagers have lots of feelings and it might remain that way or it might not. You know, just keep an open mind. And they told me about this at lunch and I was like, wait a second, I didn't get that talk.
No one told me this.
Wait, no, nobody told me I might not be gay. She did not say that to me. She said, well, my sister's a lesbian. And, you know, that's perfectly fine. It's just the way God made you. So I don't know if that was biphobia or her just pegging us very correctly.
Yes. It's a beautifully written book. I had forgotten about David Levithan's way with a phrase. There are so many times in this book that I jotted something down because I thought it spoke so well to relationships or to just the teenage experience, or that it just described a wonderful place that I want to visit. The middle of somewhere is one of the things that Paul says. Some people feel like they live in the middle of nowhere. I feel like I live in the middle of somewhere. And it's a place, reading this book, that I want to visit. I want to go back to Montclair. It's been a few years.
I have to bring Hannah out there. It's right on the PATH train. I have no excuse.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
So, Fashion Corner.
I had nothing for this.
I do.
Excellent. What's your fashion for this book?
It's Paul's outfit for the dance.
Oh. So,
the chapter, One Small Step. Saturday night arrives and I look fabulous. I am wearing a secondhand tuxedo and a pair of shoes that shine like Gibson guitar. I have folded a flower for Noah's lapel and have affixed it with my grandmother's pin with pride. My parents are stunned when they see me. I don't look like a kid anymore. I don't look like an adult either, but I definitely look older than a kid.
He elaborates on that outfit at the end of the previous chapter. This is the Dowager Dance.
And the theme is death.
Yes, the theme is death. And it's wonderful. Instead of asking people to dress up in costume, we've asked them to wear heirlooms. I will wear my grandfather's watch and my grandmother's heart-shaped pin. In my pocket, I will carry a monogrammed handkerchief that my other grandfather took to war. Alongside it will be a letter my grandmother wrote to him in those years, full of words of undying love. I'd like to think that as I dance, they will be in some way alive again. I will revive them with my thoughts and feelings. How beautiful is that?
It's so beautiful. So, 100% absolutely recommended.
Yes, with the caveats that we mentioned at the beginning of the podcast. Take the content warnings, do with them as you like. Remember when this book was written.
And also remember that there's other amazing books that this book has inspired.
That's true. Do you have a read alike? I'm going to say that sentence again. Read aloud because I'm a preschool teacher. Do you have a read alike for Boy Meets Boy?
My read alike is stepping backwards a little bit in time, and I'm recommending Girl Goddess Number 9 by Francesca Leah Block.
Yes.
So David Levithan says that Wheat Zubat, her first novel and the one she wrote when she was 19 years old. When I was 19, I was writing sad fan fiction and crying over Remus Lupin.
Fake Ani DiFranco songs. That's what I was writing when I was 19. It was the 90s and I had a guitar.
I was writing fake Weird Al songs, so don't feel bad.
Oh, I went through that in high school. But Francesca Lea Block.
Yes, so this is probably the most 90s book you will ever read, and that's amazing. I would like to particularly mention this book because it has the first positive portrayal of lesbians that I ever read in my life. I was 13. The story is called Dragons in Manhattan. It's about a girl with two moms who decides to go looking for her father. It is an incredibly positive portrayal of a cis lesbian and trans lesbian couple, especially for the time it was written, keeping in mind that the generational trauma that Francesca Lea Block was writing about was the AIDS crisis. So that is the tension that's informing her book. I'm making this, it's an amazing, beautiful, magical book full of modern fairy tales and incredible writing, in which you will see a lot of inspiration for a lot of the poetic writers you see nowadays. What's your read like?
I kept thinking, reading this book, of picture books. And part of that, I think, is just that school is starting. And part of it is that the story has these wonderful utopian elements that you see in a picture book, you know?
Absolutely. Is one of them Mermaid Parade?
No, because I don't think I've read that one.
It's quite charming. It has really fun pictures. It might not be the best read aloud, but it's a nice one to have in a library if the parents won't freak out, because it's about the Mermaid Parade in Brooklyn.
Please. I teach at a co-op in Edgewater. That's going to mean nothing to anyone.
Unless you're Bella.
I teach Bella's family.
Except she's in D.C. now because she's the president.
She is the president. All hail President Bella. So I was thinking of picture books, and I was also thinking, this will come as no surprise to you, of How I Paid for College by Mark Aceto. And we are going to talk about that book soon.
For certain.
Absolutely. I have so many things to say about that book. But what I see as commonalities between it and Boy Meets Boy are positive portrayals of queer teen characters, positive portrayals of bisexual teen characters in particular.
Positive portrayals of New Jersey.
Hey, that was my next part. Positive portrayals of New Jersey. Queer kids in New Jersey. That is my jam.
And I also know that it's not as important, but it's kind of nice to see an Italian family in young adult literature. Especially it's like something coming from the inside. It is good to see myself in that, because my family has definite parallels with the Zanies, but we will get into that in that episode.
Yeah, we will have a lot to say then. Marie, what are you reading right now?
I just read Hi-Fi Fight Club #1, written by Carly Usden. It's the first of a series of comics about a girl who works at a record shop and is inducted into a secret society full of women who save other women who are going through terrible things.
I am so excited to read this. I can't tell you. I hope it lives up to my hopes and dreams. Oh, I'll tell you what I'm reading. I am reading It's Not Like It's a Secret by Misa Sugiura. It is a diverse queer teen book. It is really enjoyable so far. And it includes the words Beach Boys debacle, which is another chapter in the story of my life. So
I was going to ask if that was your mission statement.
Beach Boys debacle. That's, I think, my memoir chapter of my late 30s.
I was talking to Carrie about the podcast Obsessed, which I am, obsessed with. And perhaps this is my narcissism, but whenever I listen to an interview podcast, I always imagine like what I would talk about if I was on that interview. So it's either super empathetic or super narcissistic.
It can be both.
And that is my DSM-5 diagnosis. That's at least 2 of the 10. Laughing so I don't cry. So I was imagining you know, if I was an Obsessed. And I said to you, you know, if I was on Obsessed, I would do Thomas the Tank Engine. Because why not further alienate our readers yes. and listeners from identifying with us in any way? And then I said to you, so what would you do and how many Beach Boys would it involve?
I can't think of anything better for us to do when we are trying to figure out what our brand is and who our target listeners are to make a podcast about young adult literature of the last 15 to 20 years and then go on a podcast and talk about Thomas the Tank Engine and the Beach Boys.
Then again, considering the branding of what I want to do, because one of my very dear friends is, among many other things, a business coach. And since she's new to working with podcasters, I get to be her guinea pig. And I've been working on sort of a identity for the people who I imagine listening to it. So we all know about Manic Pixie Dream Girls, which, by the way, the author, one, regrets creating. Yes. And also, Manic Trick Pixie Dream Girls, if you identify that way, you're amazing and wonderful. And we love you. And we want you to have all the magical, wonderful adventures you have with or without a person. Like, we have 100% nothing against Manic Pixie Dream Girls.
Yeah, I've always wanted to be one. It's the depression that keeps getting into the way of it. Admire them. Yeah.
So I was saying, you know, Manic Pixie Dream Girls were more like neurotic, nerdy house elves.
When I imagine who's listening to this, it's like the Simpsons characters Bort and Liza. They look exactly like us, except maybe the way we would have been drawn 15 years ago. A little cruder. Our dad talks a little more like Walter Matthau than he does now.
See, I picture both Mabel and Louise listening to this, which are both, they're two sides, like the id and knee super ego of Kristen Schaal. But, but yes, that is who we would love to reach out to.
Yes. So, Kristen Schaal, please listen to us.
We love you. We'd love to interview you. You don't have to read a young adult book.
No, you could just teach us how to be awesome. I love her. All right. I think we are done. Next week, we've got a new book to read, a new old book to read that will hopefully become
figure
one
out
that you love too. Oh, I think I know which one we're going to do. I think we're going to try and re-record last week's book again.
Yes. Yes. Absolutely. Readers and listeners, stay tuned. It's a really good one.
All right. So I think we're going to sign off. This has been Go Your Own YA, and I have and continue to be Carrie.
And I'm Marie.
And we will see you next week.
Do something good for yourself and bad for the patriarchy.